Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. You've likely heard all about Apollo 13, but what about the mission that came right after that near disaster? 50 years ago, on January 31st, 1971, Commander Alan Shepard, America's first man in space and the only one of the original seven astronauts to fly to the moon, Command Module Pilot Stuart Roosa and Lunar Module Pilot Edgar Mitchell lifted off from the Kennedy Space Center on an ambitious mission to explore the Fra Mauro Highlands, which was the original target of Apollo 13. The mission, like every Apollo flight, had its share of challenges, and over the next two episodes, you'll find out how close this mission came to not achieving its goal of being the third successful lunar mission.
Looks like you're about on the bottom step and on the surface. Not bad for an old man.
Okay, you're right. Alan's on the surface, and it's been a long way, but we're here.
In this episode, we'll hear from Apollo historian and filmmaker Jackson Tyler, lunar geologist Clive Neal, and while none of the Apollo astronauts are alive today, we did manage to connect with some family members to get their perspectives. These special episodes, which will take you inside the story of Apollo 14, would not have been possible without the help of some very special friends. First and foremost, Apollo flight director Jerry Griffin and his daughter Gwen, along with Amy Bean, the daughter of Apollo 12 astronaut Alan Bean. So strap yourself in and get ready for liftoff as we look back at the epic flight of Apollo 14 50 years ago. To put the mission into historical perspective, we're joined by YouTube filmmaker and Apollo history buff Jackson Tyler.
I've always been fascinated in space flight, and I wanted to see something a bit more in-depth than I could get from sort of Netflix or the Discovery Channel, and although there are a lot of great series out there, I found myself kind of looking into how do I collect this film and how can I sort of assemble it into something that I want to see. And it sort of grew organically from there. YouTube was just the easiest and most convenient place to put these videos, so I started uploading them. And, you know, one viewer at a time, other people just started filtering in, and it's built itself to something that I never expected it would have.
Well, let's talk about the Apollo 14 documentary. What were some of the most interesting challenges you found as you were trying to present that story?
Well, Apollo 14 is, from a filmmaker's perspective, it has no shortage of drama. It was, I think, if I can thinking of any Apollo mission other than 13, the one that's most rife with potentially mission-ending or mission-changing issues is Apollo 14. They encounter several issues along the way, the very nature of the mission. It's a very important mission, one to pay attention to when looking at the whole scope of the moon landings holistically, because it's really the mission that makes possible the larger extended scientific explorations of 15 through 17. So it was challenging like any film is, but in terms of being able to identify sort of the challenging factors and the motivation and the drive, it was quite easy because the drama is real and it's there and nothing is certain. When these things are happening, obviously nothing is set in stone. And so it's really was kind of hit or miss there for a while.
Well, maybe without doing all of them, what was perhaps like one of the moments in the mission you found most, you know, dramatic?
Yeah, it would probably be for me the computer issues that they encounter in trying to land on the moon. So the Apollo guidance computer, which in the LEM is called the PINGS, is the most complicated flight computer ever up to that point. It's one of the most advanced computers in the world for its time. So it's certainly over the head of most people in mission control and the astronauts as far as the inner workings of how it actually operates. And so this problem occurs, which no one really knows the solution to, except for a young software engineer, Don Iles. He happened to be present in Houston sort of as an attaché on behalf of the Draper Lab, the folks who designed the thing.
While we got that display up, Ed, could you tap on the panel around the abort push button and see if we can shake something loose? Okay, I guess you've surmised already that we have some sort of contamination in the abort switch.
and he comes up with what is essentially a software fix for a hardware problem.
Hello, Tom. You think we're going to come up with something on this problem with the abort button?
Roger. We're working it right now, and also MIT's working it. Needless to say, we're busy here, but we think we got a solution.
Essentially, it's an ingenious solution, and he comes to this conclusion in basically the space of an hour that it really kind of pulls the whole mission together and saves it in a very defining, stark moment that is captured on audio and video for all of us to see.
Yeah, it's quite a cliffhanger of a moment, because without that fix, no landing on the moon, probably.
Exactly. I think what really touched me with Apollo 14 is that on top of everything that we were talking about, it being a crossroads mission for the program and for all of this other stuff, it's also, in some ways, a story of vindication for its commander, Al Shepard, who had struggled for a very long time up to that point in trying to get a flight assignment and overcome a disorder that he was dealing with. And the press at the time called the crew of Apollo 14 the rookie crew, because they only had 15 minutes of spaceflight experience between them. So it was a human story in being able to say, hey, we've done the training, we know the flight, the system works, and let us do this. And the astronauts pulled it off, and they had some frustrations during the mission, perhaps more than other missions would face, obviously, except for 13, but they did a remarkable job, and those guys deserve all the credit they can get.
Apollo 14 will forever be the moment in which NASA truly overcame the demons of Apollo 13 and reclaimed a late president's dream of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to Earth.
Thanks to Jackson Tyler, his YouTube channel, Homemade Documentaries, features outstanding content on the Apollo missions to the moon 50 years ago. Our next segment is a truly special look at Command Module pilot Stuart Roosa, aeronautical engineer, smoke jumper, Air Force test pilot, and NASA astronaut. Stu Roosa was also a dad, and I asked my good friends Amy Bean and Gwen Griffin, both Apollo kids, as the daughter of astronaut Al Bean and flight director Jerry Griffin, respectively, to visit with three of the children of Stu Roosa, Alan, Christopher, and Rosemary. Here's their conversation, recorded in early December of 2020.
I'm Colonel Christopher Roosa, retired United States Marine Corps Reserve, and I was age 11 when my father lifted off.
Yeah, hi, this is Alan Roosa. I'm the third of four children, and when my dad lifted off, I was just about to turn 9. I was just about a month and a half short of being 9 years old.
I am Rosemary Roosa. I am an author of a book called To the Moon, and I am also president of the Moon Tree Foundation. And I was 7 years old when my father blasted off to the moon, and I am the youngest and the only daughter.
That's right. You're outnumbered by all these guys, aren't you? Now, it's great to have you all here with us.
Great to be here.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a pleasure.
So I am thrilled to be talking to you guys, especially since you were the next mission that made it to the moon after Apollo 12. And, you know, my father with Pete Conrad walked on the moon then, and then 14 was the next one to make it. So it's, do you remember when your dad came to NASA, when he was selected as an astronaut and what that was like? And
well, this is Christopher. You know, for the background, my father grew up in a small town of Claremore, Oklahoma. They were very poor growing up. They raised chickens for a living to sell to the eggs to the local market. But he knew all his life he wanted to fly. And he knew that at the age of 7, and he spent his youth working toward it, and then got selected for the Air Force. And then when he was a fighter test pilot, got selected to go to NASA, and that was in 1966. Now, with my dad being in the Air Force, we moved quite a bit, but before he got assigned to NASA, we were moving about every 2 years. So the idea that we were moving to Texas to go to NASA was just another sequence of events in his career. I think one of the things that I would say is, as an astronaut kid, is it's not like your father's the president of the United States and he's the only person. I mean, you're going to school with all the other astronaut kids. So some kid's dad has already flown twice in space, and your dad's going to fly, and then somebody else's dad's going to fly after yours.
My father knew at a young age that he wanted to be a pilot, so he did everything he could to become a pilot. And so he read magazines and he built model airplanes. And so as soon as he could, he joined the Air Force and quickly became a fighter pilot. And then from there was chosen at Edwards and then became part of NASA in 1966. So I was only three. He seemed to have a destiny, in my opinion. He knew his track and it took him all the way to the moon.
This is Alan. The only thing I'll add is my parents used to talk about this story where one time they were on vacation or they were out in the high desert. And this is before my father was stationed at Edwards. They were going out there on vacation. And as they were approaching the front gate of Edwards, my mom was driving and she turned on the turn signal. It was like what Rosemary just said. You could tell it was part of that thing. It's like, if we can get to Edwards, bigger things will happen. And so obviously, and Christopher mentioned it too, that from Edwards was our move to Houston and then obviously on to the program at NASA.
This is Christopher. If I could just add in that, you know, at that time there were only 28 astronauts in the astronaut corps. So, I mean, you're dealing with, you know, the top 0.1 percentile of people who have the ability to fly jets and get selected for fighter test pilot and then get selected for NASA. I mean, they were all driven with a passion to fly.
Absolutely. So I've got a question. You know, obviously we were all little kids or younger kids when we moved to Houston. Same with me. I was 6 months old when my dad became a flight controller in Gemini and then went on as a flight director for all the Apollo missions. And, you know, by the time 14 rolled around, what do you remember most about knowing your dad, the thoughts that you had about knowing your dad was going to go to the moon?
Well, this is Christopher. I'll take first stab at it. I'm not so sure that it's that way. I mean, my father was a fighter test pilot, and, you know, he was flying things and doing things, and, you know, this just seemed another sequence in his career.
Okay.
I mean, what I remember was, if people forget that the Apollo 14 crew was the original crew for Apollo 13.
Right.
And due to some changes in NASA management decision-making, they switched the 13 and the 14 crews. Now, I can remember when I was 10 years old, my mother called me into their bedroom and told me that my father had been selected to fly on Apollo 13. And she told me I couldn't tell anybody. And I can remember being at school and a kid walked up to me and said, "Hey, Walter Cronkite announced last night that your father's going to fly on Apollo 13. And I rode home as fast as I could from school because I was terrified that my mother would think that I was the one who told somebody.
That's classic.
And so when I came into my mother, I'm like, "I didn't say anything. I promise. And she just laughed and said, "No, that was leaked by NASA."
Good for you. You're off the hook, right? Yeah. How about you, Alan? What do you remember most about your dad's assignment?
Yeah, at my age, this is Alan. And at my age, I don't recall so much my dad walking in and saying, "Hey, I'm on a crew," like what Chris was just talking about. I do remember the changes that were happening pretty close into launch, you know, where all of a sudden Secret Service agents show up. Yeah. You know, there's a lot of security that shows up, a lot of reporters show up. And, you know, in El Lago where we lived, you'd seen that happen to the other astronaut kids, but it was just kind of a weird feeling knowing that it is your brief moment in this kind of weird zone of press scrutiny, security, Secret Service agents. And I just remember that the most about that time period, you know, when we were going into the launch.
Yeah, a little different for sure.
Okay, and for your information and the audience in the back here, we have most of the family in the night, or this morning down here, I should say.
Yeah, 3:15 is a good time at night to have a TV show.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our look back at Apollo 14 50 years ago. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's get back now to our conversation with my special guest hosts, Amy Bean and Gwen Griffin, as they talk to three of the adult children of Apollo 14 Command Module pilot Stu Roosa, Alan, Christopher, and Rosemary Roosa.
Did you guys go to the Apollo 14 launch, and did you kind of adjust your family schedule too to his training, like, similar to us, and spend some time at Cocoa Beach, or did y'all do that too?
This is Christopher. Yes, we did. In fact, we were down at the Cape one time, and my father took us into the VAB, the Vertical Assembly Building, where they stacked the rockets, and he took us and all the kids up to the top, and he had us touch the capsule, and he said, "If I die, I want you to know I'm doing what I love." So this was obviously after the accident on Apollo 13 and the fire on Apollo 1. So he made it clear to us on that. Yes, we were at the launch. I can remember walking up to my mother and saying, "Well, what am I supposed to say?" And she said, "You're supposed to say Godspeed." So when the rocket lifted off, I started yelling Godspeed as loud as I could, as fast as I could. And I remember after the rocket disappeared, I looked over and there was a kid about my age, about 11. And he gave me the strangest look, and I couldn't figure out if he was looking at me because I was crazy because I was screaming so much, or if he was looking at me thinking his dad's on top of it.
I just remember, this is Alan. I just remember we were in the astronaut viewing section, and we were down there. You know, they had that little temporary building, but we were actually down on the rope line, you know, overneath the swamp. You know, you're looking across over to the launching pad. And I remember I was just thought it was so cool, you know, and as you know, Amy, and the feeling of a Saturn V going up is something that very few people, if you haven't been there, you can't describe it, because just the way that, you know, it shakes your ribs, the power of it. But I remember, I just thought it was the coolest thing. And it goes up through the cloud and everything else. And I thought it was so awesome. I ran up the lawn and my mom's crying. And I remember my first feeling was like, did something happen? Why are we crying? This is awesome. And I remember she was like, "No, I'm crying because I'm happy." And I still remember as an 8-year-old kid going, "Crying because you're happy. I don't know what that means." I get that one, but obviously,
Well, this is Rosemary, and I a little tidbit on Apollo 14, it was the first flight to have all the families at the launch. And I remember as a kid just watching, you're there, you feel the energy in the air. And when finally it launched, it was the first mission to also have a delay. As you well know, Amy, on Apollo 12 with the lightning strike, I mean, they were very concerned when there was some clouds that moved in. And so it was the first mission to have a delay in the program. But after 40 minutes, it did launch. And I just remember as a little kid, the earth shaking, and it felt like an earthquake. I think that what's hit me too. And when the flames shot out, because it's such a huge rocket, and it just kind of sat there for a moment. And so you see the flames, you see the smoke, and you can really just feel the energy and the people, you know, crying out, is it going to go? And so that's what I remember most. And then when it cleared the tower, there was just a lot of elation in the air and a lot of screaming. Didn't know that with you, Chris, but anyways, very, very exciting.
You know, our dads were gone a lot during the Apollo program. They were training, they were working, they were doing sims, and they weren't home a lot. And Amy and I have talked about this quite a bit, where our moms wore so many hats. I have a brother. I cannot imagine four kids in the Roosa household. Talk a little bit about your mom, if you will, and you know, the challenges she faced and how she dealt with that, if you guys don't mind.
This is Rosemary. Mama really understood what Daddy was doing. And she often said she may have had a little bit of advantage over the other wives because she married my father when he was already in his career. Mm-hmm. And he was a fighter pilot, where a lot of the wives married earlier. They were either high school sweethearts or perhaps in college. And so she really had a little bit of an upper hand in that one, because she knew that he was going to be traveling a lot and gone a lot. So she really supported what he was doing. And, she tried to be the disciplinarian and not wait till your father gets home. And so she, I just know that she felt like she wanted when my father was at home to have quality time, not necessarily quantity time.
That's what I remember as well. Interesting. How about you, Alan?
What I do love about her is, and I'll amplify what Rosemary is saying, is she knew her role, but she was also, I guess the best way for me to describe it, she was raised in as a very genteel Southern lady. So she did a phenomenal job preparing us for things like state dinners and press interactions. And so she had our head screwed on right when the flight was coming in terms of how you should approach people. And in the way that she managed all that, there are many times where we kind of went into our show when we were on stage in Chicago or New York or at the White House. We were all always, yes, sir, no, sir, yes, sir, I'm very proud, yes, sir, I would like to be an astronaut. You knew the stock answers. Not, she didn't prep us on that stuff, but we knew which fork to use. So she did a phenomenal job kind of giving us the, not only the tools to manage it, but also, I remember she told me, she was like, she's like, look, for about 10 days, the press will be fawning over you, trying to get a story, and then they're gone. Don't let this go to your head. And I remember that. That was a clear lesson.
I'm going to make this short because I know we're tight on time, but I would say that my mother was an amazing woman, and but it was very clear that my parents were a team, and they loved each other both very, very much and supported each other in whatever their endeavors were.
That's great.
Yeah, I agree.
I agree, Amy. The buzzword that we used to always learn and use was, it's great. How does your father feel about going to the moon? It's great. A little bit like Tony the Tiger, you know, thrilled, proud, and it's great.
I think all the astronaut wives, you know, you, yeah. As my mother always said, you know, we had to do everything. You know, we just had to take they over did. All aspects of the life, the family life, the home life. And but they were good at it. They were good at it and proud to do it. And I don't think any of them would change a thing. I never heard anybody complain. And I have to say that's a lot. Now, after you guys came back, your dad came back from 14. Did y'all go on a tour of the United States with them or go to the White House or anything special like that?
This is Christopher. What people need to also remember about 14, it was the first flight that had pre-flight quarantine because of the exposure to the measles on Apollo 13. We had 3 weeks before the flight that we weren't allowed to see or touch our dad. We could see him behind glass. Then we had the mission for 9 days, and Apollo 14 was the last flight to have post-flight quarantine for another 3 weeks afterwards. Mm-hmm. So when quarantine ended, we were invited to go up to Washington, D.C. It turns out that we were getting a tour of the White House, and Alan Shepard had a daughter that was 20. And at that time, you had to be 21 to attend a state dinner, and President Nixon was going to be promoting Alan Shepard to admiral that night. And Alan Shepard asked if his daughter Laura could attend. And President Nixon came back and said, let all the kids come. So to the best of our knowledge, we were the first astronaut kids to ever attend a state dinner at the White House. I think Rosemary holds the record for being the youngest person to ever go to a state dinner at the White House at the age of 7.
Wow.
We all came back with these invitations, and my mother was all like freaking out because all the other astronaut kids had eaten in the kitchen. And so we were dressed to eat in the kitchen of the White House. And so now we were having to get ready to go to a state dinner, and I had apparently put on red socks, and that was not appropriate. And I was told to go change. Yes. And then we got to go to Camp David, where we spent several days, and then we went to Chicago and had a big ticker tape parade by Mayor Daley. And then we went back home to go to school, and my parents continued on to New York City.
Mm-hmm. So one of the last questions I have for you guys along those lines is, I read an interview or a bio that Jack that where he said, you know, when your dad left NASA, obviously went into the private sector when after the Apollo missions, and that he said, you know, once it was over, you're just like a normal kid now trying to make your grades and pressing on. And he was kind of talking about what was that transition like for you guys? You know, all of a sudden you're You're not going to the White House in Camp David.
This is Alan. I would disagree with that. I think going in, we knew that it was my dad and my mom that were part of this team. We were along for the ride. You know, when all that stopped, I think we just moved on. I mean, and if you look at a reflection of where we all went, you know, you got Christopher is a colonel in the Marine Corps. Jack and I went to the Air Force Academy. We jumped out of airplanes. We all learned how to fly. You know, I never looked back after it was done. Only thing I would do is if I was bringing guests to our house in Gulfport, Mississippi, where there was some space memorabilia, I would never share normally with anyone that my dad was an astronaut unless they asked. And so I remember bringing people home and they would freak out the fact that they've known me for 2 or 3 years and I never mentioned that my dad was an astronaut.
And Amy, I'm going to ask this question to you. I mean, one of the things that I found was growing up as a son of an astronaut, it didn't matter what I did. I mean, I could win a track meet. I could get a part in a play. I could get something of my own achievement. And people would cut it down by saying, well, the only reason you got that is because your dad was an astronaut. And so, we're living in long shadows of these guys. So I was the same way. I just wouldn't tell people because I wanted people to accept me on my own merits.
Yeah, no, and I think that can be a concern when you have high achieving parents. You know, you want to try to make it on your own, and it you know, it's hard to match going to the moon.
You're right.
You're in that, yeah. That's a tough one to meet. But I was like you guys. I never said anything about my dad being an astronaut until I got older. And then I realized that people wanted to know. They didn't think about it being as bragging or anything, too. They just wanted to know because it was kind of a really cool thing. And so now, if I was to have a friend, I don't sit there and bring it up right away or anything. But if I was to have it to them, I might mention it to them just as my background because they want to know. You know, that's like a cool thing. And I think, well, gosh, I'd want to know if somebody had kind of an interesting background like that. But yeah, when I was younger, definitely that wasn't something that was brought up. Now, when did your dad leave the space program? Was it soon after Apollo 14? And then where did he go?
Well, this is Rosemary. He left NASA in 1976.
Okay.
And he would have been chosen for the shuttle, but he came home and he told my mother, you know, we're kind of reinventing the wheel. And so I think he definitely was a man of challenge and just felt like there was going to be a lull in the progress of NASA. So he wound up coming home and announcing that the family was moving to Greece. So at a very impressionable age for me, at the age of 12 going on 13, we wound up moving to Athens, Greece, and he worked for a corporation that was doing business in the Middle East. But eventually just decided to go into business and started a beer distributorship here in Mississippi.
If you don't mind me jumping in, this is Alan. Uh-huh. I think more than just the careers is, and you've experienced this, is the legacy of these folks. You know, I take great joy that my 14-year-old son still likes to go flying with me. You know, when my daughter turned 18 in September, we went skydiving together. You know, there's the legacy of these folks that jumped out of airplanes or flew fighter jets that pushed themselves to seek new challenges, more than just careers. I like to see it reflected now in mm-hmm. another generation of these kids.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'd like to, what do you think your dad would think about all the commercial efforts that are going on, the planned lunar return and so on?
Well, this is Christopher. I mean, you know, my dad, you know, was very proud of what he did to get the American space program moving. He would be proud of whatever we're doing to go up into space. I mean, he believed that it's something that man has to do. Man has to continue to explore it. Man has to go out and create civilizations, whether that be on the moon or Mars. I mean, he believed in that. And I think seeing this commercialization of space, he would be fully supportive. I mean, I know he was deeply disappointed when they shut down the shuttle program and we had to start flying American astronauts on Russian rockets.
Yeah.
So.
Well said.
This is Rosemary. I would agree with that he felt like that one day that space travel should be just as airline travel is today. And I think he would be very excited and would love to inspire new generations to always seek adventure and challenges. And I'm proud of the fact that we're going to commit a woman to step on the foot of the moon with Artemis.
That's right. That's
right. This is Christopher again. I mean, I think none of the astronauts would have believed that at the end of Apollo 17, and Gene Cernan used to say that nobody would think that 50 years later we hadn't been back again. I mean, it's a shame that we stopped it. I mean, all the technology that we had, the spinoffs that came out of the space program, from Velcro computers, you know, lightweight materials to build tennis rackets, golf clubs, all of those things that we use every day, people don't realize are spinoffs of the Apollo program trying to get to the moon.
Yes. Well, thank you so much, Christopher and Rosemary and Alan Russo, for joining us here with Gwen Griffin and I on Blue Dot. We always like to reconnect and see what our fellow Apollo kids are up to and just hear some stories about your mom and dad that we didn't know before. So thank you so much for sharing those with us.
Thanks for letting me be a part of this today. It's fun to share the stories.
Let's turn our attention now to the lunar module pilot, Edgar Mitchell. Mitchell was the sixth man to walk on the moon, but he is also known for his interest in human consciousness. And after his NASA career, he founded the Institute of Noetic Sciences. Amy Bean and I caught up with the chairwoman of the board of the Institute, Claudia Wells, who also connected us with Ed Mitchell's goddaughter, Antares Davis, who is named after the Apollo 14 lunar module.
I was born 5 days before his launch.
Oh, so you remember it vividly then?
I remember it so vividly, yeah. my mom was actually supposed to go up to the launch. If she was going to start giving birth during the launch, he had arranged for her to have a helicopter take her off the base. But I was born 5 days before the launch, and she threw the baby at the nurse and flew up there herself.
Wow. When did you, you know, first become aware that, you know, he was this extraordinary person who walked on the moon? When did that awareness come about for you?
God, I mean, as long as I can remember, I mean, you know, as a kid, you kind of think, well, everybody must have an astronaut as, you know, as a godfather, but he was just kind of always this amazing person, but he was so incredibly humble that, you know, if someone didn't know who he was, you would just say, oh, okay, it's just a regular guy. But I mean, from as young as I can remember, he always influenced me and just in the way of thinking and, you know, I just always looked up to him.
The thing I think is so interesting is your name, Antares. Now, I understand that Ed Mitchell named the lunar module Antares. Do you know why he did that? And, you know, kind of the background of your name?
Sure. It's a star in the southern hemisphere in the constellation Scorpio. It's one of the brightest stars. And he named the lunar module Antares because it was the last star that he took a fix on before landing on the moon.
Really?
I'm almost 100% positive that is, you know, 99.9% positive that is correct. If there's any historians and I am wrong, I apologize. But I was born 5 days before the launch. And they all were thinking that I was going to be a boy. I popped out a girl. They didn't have a name for me. And so he helped name me after his lunar module.
Ed was like really interested in all kinds of interesting things like extrasensory perception and what, you know, what's beyond our normal understanding of the universe and what might be considered by some beyond mainstream science. Tell us, Claudia, about how he became involved in this Institute of Noetic Sciences. How did that come to be?
Well, it came to be because when he returned from his mission to the moon, he returned with a new mission, which was to found this Institute of Noetic Sciences, where I'm a chairman. And it's because in space, he had this epiphany, an experience that he really didn't expect to have. but that I think he was primed for because he was already so curious about humanity and about the nature of the universe. And actually, we've learned that that's a requirement for having the kind of experience that he had in space. But the epiphany was about the oneness of everything in the universe and himself included. And he described it as an explosion of awareness, and it was accompanied by a sense of ecstasy. And this was such a new experience for him, and one that he couldn't explain by his training, you know, in the materialist scientific paradigm, that when he came to Earth, he had this new mission to understand what happened to him. And what I think is really remarkable is that he didn't just want to understand for himself, but he wanted to share this understanding with the rest of humanity.
Well, that's interesting. Go ahead, Amy.
Let me ask you, Antares, did he, when he spent time with you, when he spent time with family and friends, did he talk about this experience that he had? Or
Sure, absolutely. He talked about it all the time. You know, he was so fascinating because not only could he talk to scientists and the brightest minds on our planet, but he could also talk to little kids at their level. You know, he would always kind of read the room and know how to talk to people. But oh yeah, he always talked about his experience in space and about noetics and about all the different things that he was studying in his life. And I mean, pretty much every Christmas, or Thanksgiving, I would sit next to him, you know, at the dining room table. And our conversations went really deep. Of course, there were some family members that, you know, had curious looks on their faces and just kind of like, huh, I don't know what they're talking about, but okay. Mm-hmm. But he absolutely did. And people always wanted to ask him about it. And, you know, I can even remember as a teenager, just sitting around the kitchen table with a half a dozen of my friends. And we were all asking him questions, and he would just, you know, talk to my teenage friends for mm-hmm. hours. So yes, he was always, you know, always imparting that knowledge on pretty much anybody that wanted to listen. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So I hear you two are collaborating on a film. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. I have been directing and producing a documentary about Ed's life, along with my co-director, Cameron Judy. And Claudia is one of our executive producers, and it's called The Space Less Traveled. And it's a documentary about Ed's life. We're really excited. We filmed with him before he passed away. We filmed with him for 3 years. We traveled all across the country with him and, filmed with him in his house on a, you know, daily, and just had this, you know, amazing, unprecedented access to him that you wouldn't normally have with someone of his, his high status. I mean, you know, when I think a lot of times when documentary filmmakers film with people, you know, they have a few weeks or a month where they film with them. But I mean, we filmed with him for 3 years, and he never said no to us and we showed up a lot. So, we're really excited. We have pretty much everything in the can. And now we need to go into post-production and edit.
And when will this be released?
Good question. COVID has slowed us down a little bit. Yeah. I'm not exactly sure, but if any of your listeners want to follow along, it's called The Space Less Traveled. And, you know, we have Facebook and Instagram and everything like that. He just led such an incredible, fascinating life that it was a story that I had been wanting to tell for years. And he agreed to do it, and just, we feel so honored.
Amy, anything else you want to ask?
No, I did want to ask, well, I guess one last thing. I was thinking about Ed. What year did he pass away there?
He passed away, interestingly enough, it was 2016, and it okay. was actually the date. I want to say it was February 5th, and because I remember it was the anniversary of his descent onto the moon.
Oh my. Yeah.
Wow.
Okay. Well, wow. I just wonder, you know, I noticed when I read his book, he was such a forward thinker about so many issues, whether it was climate change, Earth's population effect on the Earth. And so I just wondering, you know, when he was thinking those thoughts. And well,
he's not here
with us.
I agree. And I hope our documentary can, you know, bring it to the consciousness of more people too. But he was talking about all of that stuff, you know, for almost 50 years. Mm-hmm. And he's always been ahead of his time. I mean, just incredible. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was definitely one of the more cerebral of the astronaut corps and had some just really, you know, fascinating insights in later documentaries and interviews I saw with him. Just a really thoughtful person. And and I'm so glad that you were able to share him with us today, because he needs to be represented as we look back on the incredible mission of Apollo 14. So thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
We enjoyed it.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll find out about why NASA was so interested in the Apollo 13 landing site that they decided to send Apollo 14 there after 13 failed to land in the Fra Mauro Highlands.
Apollo 14, Houston.
Go ahead.
Your go for the moon, go for TLI.
Roger, go for TLI.
Stay with us as we look back at Apollo 14 50 years later. And we're back as Blue Dot looks back at the flight of Apollo 14 50 years ago. Let's turn our attention now to the geology aspect of the mission. Our guest is lunar geology expert Clive Neal from Notre Dame University. Clive Neal, welcome once again to Blue Dot.
All right, thanks very much for having me, Dave.
Well, let's talk about the landing site of Fra Mauro. It was originally supposed to be the landing site for Jim Lovell's crew on Apollo 13, and you know, we all know what famously happened to prevent that from happening. Yeah. Why was it so important that they decided that we're going to send Apollo 14 there?
Well, if you look at the near side of the moon, then where Apollo 14 actually landed was in the impact ejector from the Imbrium Basin. That's to the north of the landing site, and that contained a huge impact basin that was subsequently filled with lava flows. But the ejector contained basically a cross section of materials that were, you know, through the crust, and then any ancient lava flows that were there before the impact actually occurred, because we have samples from Apollo that tell us that the Imbrium basin formed about 3.85 billion years ago, so, you know, plus or minus a couple of hours. And so you've got this snapshot in time. And the materials that were brought back were hoped to sort of contain some of the pre-Imbrium materials, pre-Imbrian lithologies. And it turns out that they did.
So in other words, just much older samples of the original lunar crust.
That's correct. Some of the oldest lavas were actually described from the Apollo 14 sample collection. If we look at those from Apollo 12, which is close by to Apollo 14, those are younger down, you know, younger than Imbrium, basically. So you've got the Apollo 14 samples that actually had lava flows much older than we've got lava flows on this planet, around about 4.2, 4.3 billion years ago.
Could you describe the topography of Fra Mauro a bit for us to give us a picture of how different that was than, say, the Apollo 11 and Apollo 12 landing sites?
Well, if you can look at it now, because we have the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter images of all the landing sites. The landing site was actually in a shallow valley between ridges of the Fra Mauro formation. That was a relatively benign landing site, but this was a lot more topography in this area than you saw at Apollo 11 and Apollo 12, because of the fact that this is just, rather than plains of lava flows, so to speak, these were hummocky terrains of impact ejecta. So trying to find somewhere that's relatively benign to land, they chose this shallow valley between these two ridges to do that. And the other part of landing there was to actually try and see if any ejecta from Copernicus could be defined. But it turns out that Apollo 12 contained that particular sample rather than Apollo 14.
Well, and you, when you first started working on lunar samples, you told me that some of the first samples you ever worked on were from Apollo 14. Is that right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes. My first trip to Johnson Space Center, 2 weeks after arriving in Knoxville, Tennessee, in July 2nd, 1986. And coming from England and ending up in Knoxville, you think you've died and gone to hell because it's so hot and humid. But 2 weeks later, I was in Houston and realized that Knoxville was on the edge of hell looking in, because Houston was dead center with the humidity and the heat. And this poor sort of fragile Englishman. We have a very benign climate in the UK compared to Houston, Texas. But I was then sent down there 2 weeks after arriving to start working on some samples from Apollo 14. To extract samples for analysis, and led to my first research paper on Apollo samples from breccias. These breccias that I was looking at, these are fragmental rocks made up of other lithologies, all sort of welded together in an impact melt welding going on. So these were definitely broken up due to the impact and then re-welded. And this is where we started to see some of these ancient lava flows and some of the crustal materials that were there, and also even granites, which are unheard of in terms of lunar geology, because most of it is much less silica rich in the sort of basalt lava flows and gabbro intrusives. But granite was a bit of a surprise.
And can you describe, you know, some of the actual samples? They have names, right?
Well, 14321 is probably the most famous one from Apollo 14. This was a large breccia. This was called Big Bertha by the astronauts that brought it back, because it was one of these. One of these bigger samples. It was about 20 pounds, and wow. It was made up. I mean, it's what a treasure trove of materials that came out of that. Most of the compositions of lavas that we know came from little pieces of lava enclosed in 14321. Quite a remarkable place, and it also contained materials from the lunar crust. So this was quite a find by the Apollo 14 astronauts. So Mitchell and Shepard brought that back and basically launched my career in lunar geology. So thank you guys.
Yeah, that's awesome. And yeah. I also find it interesting that they called it Big Bertha, since Al Shepard is, you know, such a great golf enthusiast. And this is before they had the Callaway Golf Club, the driver called Big Bertha. I wonder if there's a connection there.
Well, maybe that was it. Yeah.
Probably not. probably not, but I'm going to think so anyway.
I'm not a golfist, so I don't know anything about that.
Yeah, anybody that says golfist, you know, is definitely not a golfer. Well, Clive, thanks for telling us about the Fraumaro landing site and the samples from Apollo 14 that you worked on.
Oh, no worries. Happy to do so, and thanks again for having me back.
Thanks to all of our guests, filmmaker Jackson Tyler, Alan Christopher and Rosemary Roussa, Claudia Wells from the Institute of Noetic Sciences, and Ed Mitchell's goddaughter Antares Davis. And a very special thanks to my guest hosts, Amy Bean and Gwen Griffin. Be sure to listen next week as we conclude our look back at Apollo 14, as we profile its commander, America's first man in space, Alan Shepard, through the eyes of his daughter, Julie. We'll also take a special look back at Shepard's famous golf shots on the moon and be joined by Apollo 13 astronaut Fred Hayes, along with Apollo flight directors Jerry Griffin and Milt Windler. So please join us as we look back on the seventh Apollo mission and the third successful moon landing that took place in early February 1971.
You're on your own.
It's turning now.
Okay. It says 90 feet. 4 feet per second. 5 feet per second down.
Okay.
Down. Looking great.
60 seconds.
Okay. 50 feet down. 50 feet.
We're in good shape, too.
3 feet per second. 40 feet. 3 feet per second. 30. 3 feet per second, looking great. 20 feet, 10, 3 feet per second, contact now.
2, stop. 3, pro, auto, auto.
We're on the surface.
Okay, we made a good landing.
Roger, Antares.
4 feet plus 10,000. That was a beautiful one.
Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio from beautiful and talented Northern California. If you missed an episode or want to recommend one, check out our archives and link to our podcast at mynspr.org. We're also on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.